Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
In the first two empathy talks, we've been looking at conflict as an interpersonal problem, as a situation that might arise between us and the other guy. Many conflicts, including many of the stresses we feel in our lives, are not simple one-on-one tiffs, but emerge at a societal level. We'll find that what we have learned in the last two talks about the anatomy of conflict, judgment, anger, unskillful speech, and the rest, carry over remarkably well to much of our understanding of society, to criminal justice, to ethnic and racial tensions, to our consumption of media and news, and even to political views. 2020 has brought massive new stresses to an already massively stressed society. We're going to have to navigate turbulent waters in the months ahead. So I thought some of these remarks may be useful about how to bring what we have learned to bear on conflict in society. To begin with, conflicts often rise with those that are particularly criminal in their behavior, stealing, physically violent, predatory, whose behavior is so ingrained and might even be a matter of livelihood, drug dealer, sniper, loan shark, and hate radio host, that they are not likely to be talked out of it. There are bad actors out there, ever deserving of empathy, but in the meantime likely to cause others harm. What do we do about them? If their criminal behaviors are likely to continue, it is incumbent upon a well-functioning society to intervene out of kindness in order to protect other members of the society. This might entail prison or some other means of limiting this person's future ability to harm people. We can bring Buddhist values to bear on criminal justice. The important thing from a Buddhist perspective is to control our judgment and anger to maintain our kindness for the criminal, with the recognition that this will need to be balanced against our kindness for the past or future victims. There's no such thing as deserving what he gets in Buddhism. We look out for the welfare of both criminal and potential victims. The criminal, like us, is a dependently arisen product of causes and conditions, suffers and warrants empathy. Now, American criminal justice is largely retributive. We try to inflict as much suffering on the criminal as he deserves. This is justified either in terms of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, or by the logic that inflicting enough pain will get the criminal and others to stop their evil ways. Nonetheless, retributive justice is an exact enactment by the society of the unwholesome human tendency to judgment, anger, and violence at the interpersonal level. It's violent by its very nature and therefore unwholesome for those who must enforce such justice. It also turns out that as a means of correcting or reducing criminality, it is misguided and largely ineffective. Consider that criminal behavior tends to be conditioned by an upbringing of deprivation, inadequate nurturing, and abuse. The prison system generally tries to correct the result by reproducing the same conditions that give rise to criminality in the first place. That makes no sense. The results are a high recidivism rate. People get out of prison and come right back in short order. Fortunately, there are alternatives that preserve the dignity of the criminal and spare him from abuse or punishment. These are implemented in other lands and are shown to be more effective in reducing criminality, as evidenced in lower recidivism rates. Similarly, the death penalty, now absent in much of the world, is clearly retributive, and research shows it has no effect on reducing the rates of violent crimes and may even increase them. An alternative to retributive justice that aligns with Buddhist values is restorative justice. Restorative justice, as per Wikipedia, is an approach to justice in which one of the responses to a crime is to organize a meeting between the victim and the offender, sometimes with representatives of the wider community. The goal is for them to share their experience of what happened, to discuss who was harmed by the crime and how, and to create a consensus for what the offender can do to repair the harm from the offense. It encourages empathy in both criminal and victim and has been shown to be very effective both in terms of low recidivism and in terms of victim satisfaction and criminal accountability. It's similar to the conflict resolution technique of nonviolent communication. Conflict is also often encouraged at the social level by the strong tendency of humans to affiliate themselves with particular social groups that then set themselves in opposition to other groups. This kind of behavior seems to reflect very natural, primitive structures of human society and is sometimes called tribalism. We organize ourselves into tribes. Similar behaviors are found among apes. As human, we identify as belonging to groups according to village or neighborhood, nation, language, religion, ethnicity, race, profession, level of wealth, politics, hobby, gender identity, or street gang. A tribe has the positive effect of promoting a group solidarity and mutual support, but the negative effect of promoting animosity and conflict with regard to other tribes. We all belong to multiple tribes. As Buddhists, another tribe, who value kindness and eschew ill will, we should take care not to fall into the negative side of tribalism. Common modern examples of tribal rivalry entail racism, nationalism, ethnic nationalism, discrimination against particular ethnic, religious, or linguistic groups, gang violence, and so on. The danger for all of us is that we fall victim to tribal thinking very readily when we hang out with others who belong to our tribe. It's hard to maintain wisdom in a mob. Often this takes the form of simply making fun or telling jokes about the other group or depicting them as stupid, lazy, ill-mannered, or whatever. Jokes like, how many X does it take to change a light bulb? We also employ a judgmental vocabulary when referring to another group. Kikes, gooks, Polacks, wetbacks, and so on. Words that, like other judgmental words, carry no real content but are somehow derogatory, as if we can sum up a person or group with a simple slur and think there's nothing more to say. Unfortunately, tribalism is easily encouraged by bad actors for political or economic gain. The Nazis in Germany in the 1930s were white ethnic nationalists defined around the myth of a superior Aryan race who declared Jews to be not only racially inferior but also backstabbers, responsible for the defeat in World War I and for German economic and social woes since then. We find an alarmingly similar trend in American politics today, though not as much directed against Jews in particular. This kind of tribalism can have deep-seated roots of hatred, but is also often exploited as an opportunity to consolidate solidarity or group identity for political purposes. Throwing in conspiracy theories about evil secret plots are an easy and effective means for stoking fear of the other tribe within one's own that turns up the volume on intertribal rivalry. Tribalism is similarly exploited in the divide and rule tactic, whereby a ruling group can control a diverse population by creating an artificial conflict between one tribe and another, so that they are unable to join forces as a unified opposition against the rulers. The British colonial powers seem to have mastered this in building their vast empire, for instance, by providing special privileges to a smaller ethnic group in order to create envy in a larger group. Most famously, they encouraged a Hindu-Muslim rivalry that resulted in much violence and political turmoil when the British finally left, and that continues to this day. Inter-ethnic tensions are also the ongoing legacy of long-ended British rule in Burma. In any case, Buddhists who wish to practice without ill will must stay clear of participation in tribal conflicts at any level. Just as we cultivate empathy for people we might otherwise come in conflict with, we should cultivate empathy for every other group, keeping in mind that any group defined along ethnic, linguistic, religious, political, or whatever parameters is not so different from whatever ethnic, linguistic, religious, or whatever groups we might belong to. They work, have jobs, try to raise their children in comfort. There will be bad actors among them, but also saints. We need to be mindful not to fall into the judgment or hatred that our co-tribalists might be encouraging. Group identity is okay. Most of the listeners of this will identify themselves as Buddhists, and we do well to support each other in our practice and in our values. But this should never, ever entail disparaging others because they don't belong to our group. If we find that we feel animosity for a particular group, maybe Catholics or homeless people or Republicans or stand-up comedians, either because of our upbringing or because we've absorbed the judgments and ridicule of those around us, a good way to practice with this is to seek out members of that group and befriend them, humanize them. We will generally be pleasantly surprised with what we discover. It will restore our kindness and empathy, and sometimes even faith in humanity. We're a deeply divided country. Much of this has historical roots in America. We were, after all, founded on the basis of racial division, initially European, African, and Native, and that division has been an open wound that ever since simply will not heal, in spite of the efforts of many well-intentioned people. Moreover, many of our social divisions, rich and poor, conservative and liberal, immigrant and non, have been artificially encouraged by bad actors for political or economic gain. Again, as Buddhists, we should be mindful not to fall into the ill will promoted by these divisions. We do best in terms of our practice and spiritual progress to retain kindness and empathy for every group as we do for every person we encounter. This does not mean we cannot evaluate groups. Many of us have decided deliberately to become Buddhists rather than Wiccans or Muslims, and it might have good reasons. But we don't need to judge them. Judging would entail shutting the door and abandoning the prospect of understanding them better. Media is an important causal factor in much of the divisiveness we discover. Radio, TV, internet, video games. We should take care to avoid sources that divide one group from another, that violate what the Buddha has defined for us as right speech. To determine if a source such as political commentary is doing this, first and foremost, listen to the language. Does it disparage whole groups of people with sweeping generalizations or graphic imagery? Is the language judgmental? It amazes me how often merely calling someone a communist, a fascist, or a Putin stooge passes for an argument in many media sources, and an argument that seems to end all debate on the matter. Does the language promote hatred and blame, or does it promote healing? Is it factual or emotionally laden? It's okay if it's critical of certain parties as long as it does so as evaluation and not as judgment. We should ask, is the information we are receiving helpful in understanding what is going on in a way that invites us to look even deeper? If a particular source does not meet these criteria, its consumption is probably unhealthy. Much of the social conflict we find is simply traceable to divergent sources of information. For instance, many people think that COVID-19 is not a serious problem or that it's a hoax. They are, as a result, unlikely to follow guidelines like social distancing and wearing masks. Others take it quite seriously and rarely leave their homes. When these two kinds of people do come into contact in public, conflict is common. "Where's your mask, buddy? Don't be such a sheep. Boy, do you look silly in that thing." If they, with best intentions, try to work out their differences, they will still reach an impasse when each concludes that the other is simply uninformed. One gets his news from CNN and the other from Fox. Even with perfect empathy, how do we convince another that our source of information is more reliable than his source of information? It's not easy. Determining what news and commentary are trustworthy and what is fake news is a skill that few master. Unfortunately, Buddhism does not really teach how to master that skill. Academics like me generally have some tips, but that leads us beyond the sphere of Buddhist wisdom, which is what this talk is meant to be about. To make things worse with regard to sources of information, there are whole organized disinformation campaigns out there deliberately intended to mislead. For many years, the oil industry has conducted a campaign that once had convinced half of Americans that climate change is a hoax. This campaign is similar to the earlier campaign waged by the tobacco industry to convince us that cigarettes do not cause cancer. As the effects of climate change have become quite apparent in the last few years for all to see, this campaign has been steadily losing ground. Contributing to both social divisiveness and misinformation is Facebook and other forms of social media driven by likes and retweets and algorithms which present the viewer with whatever matches their previous history of likes and retweets and put the viewer into a kind of echo chamber in which everyone appears to seem to agree with what the viewer believed in the first place, shutting out exposure to alternative viewpoints critical to forming informed opinions. Moreover, people are naturally drawn to drama and intrigue, and therefore the number of likes and retweets tends to trend toward conflict and silly conspiracy theories at the cost of peace and fact. I just read an interesting statistic. For every harsh, judgmental, or divisive word included in a tweet, the number of retweets increases on average by 20%. What the individual views, therefore, ends up being biased sharply towards judgmental and divisive language. My recommendation for Buddhists who want to avoid this unwholesome influence is use Facebook and other social media not at all or with very great care. Try to be informed, but do your own targeted research by looking things up on Google or Startpage to begin with. We also do well to avoid the values and viewpoints typically depicted in and learned from most TV and movie entertainment. Again, because people find conflict to be entertaining, we see repeated instances not of conflict resolution, but of conflict escalation into physical violence, often with relentless kill counts. Moreover, the grossest group stereotypes are depicted repeatedly in the media that reinforce tribal judgment and conflict. Blacks are stereotypically small-time thieves, and Hispanics are drug dealers. A common plot line in many TV shows and movies is as follows. The protagonist is harassed or otherwise irked by some group of people. For a time, he exhibits patience and restraint, may even try to empathize with this group. Predictably, that just encourages the group to act even worse. It makes him a doormat. Finally, the protagonist reaches a no more Mr. Nice Guy moment of insight and does what needs to be done, and in a great show of strength, takes out this evildoer. If evildoers die in the process, it really doesn't matter. It's just another tick of the kill counter, for they are miscreants. Captivating story, bad lesson. It seems to me that the biggest problem with this kind of entertainment is its effect on young children who are very impressionable as they formulate the values they will carry with them through the rest of their lives. By age 18, the average American kid has witnessed 200,000 acts of violence. Research has indicated for a long time a clear correlation between exposure to such programs and aggressiveness and violence in later life. Consider a 4-year-old watching a very standard TV program. They are unlikely to understand the actual issues involved in grown-up conflict. What they learn is that when grown-ups come into conflict, they resolve the conflict in only one way. Again, the message for Buddhists is beware of the entertainment industry and its influence on our practice. Be particularly aware of your children's exposure to the influence of violent program. I realize as a one-time parent that this can be difficult. If you try to restrict children's viewing habits, they just spend their time at friends' houses where such restrictions are not in place. It's not easy. We live in a very violent society. People adept at resolving conflict and producing peace and harmony are few and far between. But this is the value of Buddhism, why the growth of Buddhism is so important in this troubled land. For Buddhists, simplicity, kindness, and harmlessness are fundamental values taught at many levels in how we act, in how we speak, and in how we think. We develop kindness and compassion and devolve hatred and aggression as a matter of daily practice, ever mindful of what is skillful or wholesome and of what is unskillful or unwholesome. We're taught never to let go of kindness for all beings. As a matter of livelihood, we have nothing to do with weapons. We view each other with kindly eyes and try never to go to bed with a grudge. We do not fix on strong viewpoints, but ever move in the direction of greater understanding. We learn to see ourselves in others. We empathize with the world while acknowledging its many faults. ¶¶